We want to greet you this morning in the name of Jesus. It's kind of surprising that after work starts in Dayton, Ohio, and in Keystone, this building is as full as it is this morning. I didn't expect to see this many people here. And there's quite a few people this morning that I don't know. I haven't met your wife before, Philip. You have to do something about that when the service is over. And some others are planning to get married around here. There's a whole bench here. I don't think I know anyone on that bench, and I wish I would know who they are. I'm sure that every life here is a story, a very, very precious testimony. And like someone I think said already, we're kind of all at different places where we are in life. I was asked to bring a teaching this morning that was very, very deep, and I just thought about something that, you know, all this past week we've had very, very deep teaching, and I usually have maybe I've too frequently done that kind of thing here in this pulpit, so I thought that today I'm just going to do something very, very different, the kind of thing you're not used to hearing me talk about, and just go to something very, very simple and very, very practical, and something no one in this building will have any trouble understanding. And maybe it would be, in one sense, the word a practical application to what we just heard. How do I know my affection is set on things above and not on things of the earth? And so I'm going to just give a quick illustration here, then talk about it. I want Brother Andy and Brother Kevin to come and stand here. I don't think you'll have any trouble forgetting. I don't think you'll forget this. Set your affection on things above, not on things of the earth, for you're dead and your life is hid with Christ in God. And how do you know if you're doing that? So, let's look at this. How much is your affection set on Him? And to the extent that it is, that's the extent that it is. And how much of your affection is set here? And to the extent that it is, that's the extent to which it is. You can make this thing sound so lofty and so complicated and so deep and so spiritual and so majestic and so subjective, you can't figure out what it means, but that's what it means. When your heart is set on this young man here, and this young man's heart is set on Daddy. Now, before you sit down, I'm going to tell a story. And you say, Brother Dale, is that story true? The story is so true that in many jails, prisons where I have spoken and given this story, these great big black men, and I don't know why there's so black men and black people in the States that are in jail, but that's the way it is. I've seen these great big fellows. They look like National Football League football players. They sit there with tears running down their face. I'm going to tell you this story. So, you know, I come from the sports world. And this football coach, he had a terrible problem on his team. He had a budding star on there. He wanted to play football, but he was not worth anything on the gridiron. He was worth nothing on the field. He couldn't block. He couldn't tackle. He couldn't intercept a pass. He didn't know how to throw the ball. He couldn't catch one. He didn't know how to kick or punt. He didn't know what he was doing. He wanted to play, but he just was a poor player. And time after time, this boy would come to practice. The coach had put up with him. He never failed. He was always there. Always wanted to play. Begged the coach for the chance to play. Couldn't put him out there. The team can't lose with a man like that on the field. You only have 11 men out there. You got to fill it with the best you got. You can't put him out there. They had a championship game. The team was out in the field playing. The coach was sitting on the sideline. This young fellow was sitting right beside him. He had his uniform on. He was ready to go. He was full of energy and enthusiasm. He would like to play. He kept telling the coach, let me play. Just for a minute. Let me play. Just a little bit. Let me play. The coach said, son, you know what our problem is. We've got to win this game. But let me play. Things weren't going very well for the home team, and so the coach looked down at the boy and said, why don't you go out there for maybe 2 or 3 minutes? And the fellow said, thank you, coach. And took off for the field. The coach never saw this young fellow play football like he did in those few minutes. He never saw this performance. He never saw this achievement. He never saw this accomplishment. He couldn't figure it out. The fellow said, outstanding job. The coach called him back and said, what's going on? You've never done this. Well, the boy said, maybe he didn't know it, but my daddy just died 3 days ago. And you see, my daddy was blind. This is the first day he ever saw me play. You may sit down. Do you understand that, Kevin? Every boy wants his daddy to see him play. So does every girl. Set your affection. And I'm not talking about inordinate affection. I'm not talking about carnality. I'm not talking about foolishness of this world. I used a very carnal, athletic illustration there. My daddy never saw me play. He never came to any of the tournaments that we had. My father and mother were never there. I've got a varsity letter from athletics, but he never saw me play a game ever. I sang in some very, very elite choruses, 200 voices, 8-part music. My father and mother never heard it. I didn't know what it was like to have a daddy that saw me play. Maybe to make this get us a little closer down to where you live, this past week we were, of course, over there in Mendon. For several days prior to that, we were with my son, my oldest son. He's 52 years old. He has 5 children. And I could tell he was very delighted to have us in his house. We'd never have been with him in his house for as many days at a time as we were then. I think we were there for almost 5 days. And that has never happened since he's married. And we just had that opportunity to be there because we had a week of time between one event and another. And so we spent that time with him. And he kept telling us time after time how glad he is that we're here, how glad he is. But the last day we were there before we left for Ohio, he had me out in his little shop. He has a little 2-car type shop there. And there's a lift that lifts up the 1 car. And he didn't put that there. It was there when he bought this property. And it came with an air compressor in the corner. And the air is piped around there. You could plug in your hoses at any place around the shop. There's a nice little shop there. And he wanted to show me some tools that he had. He has this chest of tools here, and he has several chests here. And he told me what he does with these and what he does with those. He would show me his things. And I was just delighted to see what he has there, how this works out for him. It was a tremendous blessing to see that. Virgil was getting a certain benefit out of showing his daddy how this goes, and he wanted me to see how that works for him. He wanted me to see his life, and this is where I am, and this is the things that I'm doing, and I'm involved in this. And I know it was a healing thing for him. It was a blessed experience for him to be able to show me those things. And so, what does that have to do with a Sunday morning service in Vernon, Indiana? I'm going to share a couple thoughts with you this morning. I'm going to give the text for the message at the very end. Near the beginning here, I'm going to ask a question. The text at the end will answer the question. You might find yourself having forgotten what the question was before we get to the end. That'll be a mistake if that happens. So I'll try to underline this question for you when I ask it, because I'm not going to answer it. But the text at the end will answer the question. I think I'll have Kevin's attention. I don't think he'll forget what I'm going to say. And then I could have asked anyone else to come up here too. So I want us to speak very, very practically this morning, and And those boys are in jail. When they hear that story, the reason they cry is because their daddy never saw them play. Their daddy never had interest in their lives. They lived their lives alone and without dad. And there's no young man anywhere that can survive without daddy. And any man anywhere, no matter how old he is, if he's 52 years old, as my oldest son is, or if he's 75 years my age, there's no boy anywhere, and I'm a boy too because I'm a son of somebody. There's no one anywhere that can get through life well whose daddy does not see him play. That is to say, you don't have the blessing of your daddy upon your life. That is to say, you don't have his approval. That means to say that you can't please him. That means to say that you never measured up. I was over there at that Menden, and they had a speaker there, a very, very fine young man, 49 years old, soon to be 50. He might be 50 already. See, when the year 75, he 22. He might be, he was born in 75. He might be 50 by now. See, how's this here? 73. 73. He was born in 73. He's probably 49. Speaker there, and he wanted to visit with my wife and I, and so we took him over to that little cabin they gave us to stay in, and he sat there. And he had tears in his eyes. And here's this speaker that had a masterful presentation. He had an outstanding contribution to make to that meeting over there. One of the younger speakers that we had there. He said, Brother Dale, I lived under condemnation all my life at home. I never could do it well enough. Dad was never satisfied with anything I ever did. As hard as I tried, it wasn't good enough. There's a speaker in Mendon, Ohio, sitting here crying. There are probably a few people here this morning like that. Maybe you're 60 years old, but you understand those words. So I'm talking especially to fathers this morning, our grandfathers. I think we have a responsibility there. See, this comes in various levels. You can bless your daughter, bless your son for their accomplishments. You can say, I saw that, I appreciate that. That was well done, son. That was tremendous. Your child will benefit from that. But wait a minute, not every child does that well. Not every child can achieve to that level. Not every child reaches that high standard. Not every child can perform that efficiently. So let's just leave that scene and come over here. And here we have a child, your child. It did not do very well. It did not go well. There was not a very good result. It was not very commendable. It does not look like achievement. It's not going to win any awards. It's not going to win any varsity letters. It's not going to be part of National Honor Society. It's not going to reach it. Now, Daddy, Mama, how do you feel? What do you plan to do with that child? Can you walk up to that son, put your hand on his shoulder and say, Son, I'm proud of you. You did valiantly. You did the best you could. And that's all it's ever expected of your life or of mine. I'm glad for what you tried to do, and Daddy's with you, and I appreciate it, and it's an honor to me. And you know, a child that has defeats in life and didn't go so well for him, if you hear that a few times, I will tell you what will happen in a child's life, and I don't need to say it because you already know. It'll go better for him the next time than it did the last time because you heard what Daddy said. So I'm concerned about the future of your congregation. A tremendous number of young people in this church, many, many children in this church. Babies are being born all the time around here. I'm concerned how it's going to be here 20 years from now. Someone told me on Friday that they hope I'm here 20 years from now. I think there might be a slight bit of wishful thinking there. And maybe some, you know, probably not thinking very wisely. I might not be here 20 years from now, probably not. But this congregation might be, and I am very concerned about where a 5-year-old boy this morning is when he's 25 years old. Where a 10-year-old daughter is when she's 30. And 20 years goes by real fast, so you can trust me for that. I've seen 20 years go past almost 4 times in my life. It doesn't take long for 20 years to go past. But the church is continually responsible to teach and disciple the new Christians, the newly married couples, the new parents, the young people rising up into their teenage years, the new ministers that come into the congregation. We have continual teaching to do because it's continually changing. People that heard this message here, it did not apply to them, they didn't get much out of it. Now they've stepped up into this other place in life, and now all of a sudden it's very meaningful to them. And a church has to be really alert, the ministers, pastors, the teachers, very prepared to be aware that these new ones need to hear what we taught 10 years ago or 5 years ago, but now it's time to do it again. But there's a problem. Those of us who are called upon to present these lessons and to give this teaching have been ourselves faulty and needy in a very limited understanding, many of us. None of us has already attained, yet we pursue our way until the crown is won, like the song says. So what I undertake to do here this morning, I do with a lot of trepidation, with a trembling heart. I told you the text of the message will come at the end, but I want to give you an introductory verse to give you a thought about where we're going this morning. You've heard me use this phrase before, but this is in Proverbs 23. Set your affection on things above. So we had Kevin and Andy up here. This is verse 26 of this chapter. My son, give me thy heart, Andy says to Kevin. My son, give me your affection, Kevin. My son, give me thine heart, and let thine eyes observe my ways. That last phrase is very significant. You'll learn that later on this morning. And let thine eyes observe my ways. Don't you worry, Brother Andy. His eyes are doing that. You don't need to worry about that. He has noticed that very, very clearly. He can tell you exactly where you are. He knows exactly what his heart, the heart of his daddy is all about. He knows exactly the spirit of his father. He knows very exactly what his daddy's interests are. He has observed that. Your children know that by the time they're 3 years old. My son, give me thine heart, and let thine eyes observe my ways. Now here's the question. And yet underscore this question. So be very, very careful here. What is the evidence that a father or a mother has the heart of their child? What is the evidence? How do I know that I have Virgil's heart? That's our oldest son. We had 3 sons. One is not here. How do I know I have the hearts of my sons? How do you know you have the heart of your daughters? So that's the question. We'll answer it after a while. We will not achieve this holy result if we have no conscious intention to do so. You know, you're not going to set your affection on things above, not on things of the earth, without a conscious intention to do so. It doesn't happen naturally. You don't get up out of bed in the morning and say, oh, my heart is set on things above. I don't have any interest in things of this world. That I'm sorry, that's not life. And your life nor mine or anybody else's. There's a conscious pursuit there. There's an intention to do it. And if I want to have the heart of my child, something intentional was done between me and that son or that daughter. It is hard enough to accomplish even with our most sincere efforts, and will surely escape us if we are not diligently pursuing it. That's the way all worthwhile things are in life. That's the way all Christian experiences lived. I'll tell you a story that I heard from a bishop many, many years ago. He and I were friends. He was 32 years older than I was. And we were very, very different. We were in the same church grouping of churches, but he was in a different congregation. But we had a deep respect for each other, but we were very, very different. He was way, way ahead of me spiritually. And he made a tremendous influence on my life and some of the church responsibilities and administrative duties we've had in later years. I depended a lot upon his example and input into my life. And I benefited much from his teaching, but he told me this story. You see, the man had several sons, and they were farmers, and every year they did harvesting. That young man told me yesterday that they raised corn and beans, so Eli should understand this story. If he's here this morning, I don't know if he is or not. But he, this Huffman boy, he would understand this story very, very well if he was here this morning listening. But every year they got the machinery ready in the fall for the harvest. And as they were greasing the grease zirks and oiling the chains, his father would look at his sons and say, "Boys, keep your hands out of the cogs. Boys, don't get your hands in the machinery. Boys, keep your fingers away from the chains." And they heard that every year, those boys did. But one year, the daddy was out there. He had some gloves on. It was kind of chilly. He got some fodder wrapped up around some rollers there, and he thought it would be easier to jerk that out of there if the machine was still running rather than choking it up and then having to start the PTO shaft with the thing jammed. So he reached in there and grabbed his fingers and pulled them in, and in the hospital, they had to fix it up with all the fingers missing on that hand. The year went by, and the next fall came, and they got the machinery out to get ready for harvest. And Daddy held up a stub of his fist and said, "Boys, keep your fingers out of the cogs." And the most powerful testimony, the most powerful illustration that the daddy ever given to the sons. Because there was so this morning the man that talks to you, he has a hand without any fingers on, in a spiritual sense. So I'm saying to you, keep your hands out of the cogs. What I'm trying to tell you is, do not do this the way I did it. What I'm trying to tell you is, learn from my stubs. What I'm trying to say is, ask God for grace to be more intentional. Pursue it more diligently. Be more conscious about it. I was not aware of it. I learned entirely too late. Nor is this just one more admonition on child training. As important as what child training is. But to earn the heart of your child requires something much deeper than simply the nurture and admonition of the Lord, as deeply important as that is. Nurture. In the Greek language, it means discipline. Training the behavior and the actions of your child. The way the child performs, functions, responds to life circumstances. That's nurture. Admonition is teaching, oral teaching. Instruction by words. And both of them imply an intentional effort to spend quality time with each child. As parents, it can be quite upsetting for us and embarrassing too, for us to learn that others looking on, see deficiencies in our homes, see deficiencies in our children. It's disconcerting to become aware that others observe our faults. But as a parent this morning, you don't need to worry about someone else in the congregation, somebody else in the neighborhood, somebody else in the church affiliation, somebody else in a gap year fellowship, becoming aware that you have some weaknesses and needs in your family. If you find yourself there and you say, I hope no one saw that, or I hope the elders did not notice how my daughter has her hair combed this morning, or you say, I didn't think she could down the steps wearing a dress like that, or whatever your difficulty is that you think you have with your children, instead of sitting back waiting for the fur to fly or waiting for the accusations to the tongues to wag and the fingers to point, instead of sitting back wondering what others are saying about your home, let's just turn this all around and do something entirely different. If you have difficulties and you're aware of it, that not everything's going quite as well as I wish it was in with my children. Maybe I have made some mistakes as a daddy. Most daddies do. I can take the initiative. I can open myself to the brothers and sisters. I can ask for their evaluation. I can say, have you observed some things? I can request some advice. I can admit my inexperience. I can welcome wholesome criticism and suggestions from others. I can take the initiative instead of waiting and wondering and worried and concerned that someone might observe what's going on in my home. I can turn that right around and say, would you help me with my home? I can turn that right around and say, draw near. I would like to have some input into my life. Do you realize that no one will find fault with a parent with that attitude? No one will criticize you for having asked and desiring some instruction. So I have 2 points I want to make before I answer that question. I'm going to focus, first of all, on our children. And though that is an important couple of thoughts that will come to us here in a few moments, it is not the most important, because I will end then with you as a daddy and you as a mother. And we'll look at your life. Because the goal is to win the hearts of our children. So we have children. Sometimes there's wrong behavior there. It could be a son or a daughter. It's kind of interesting, but you have observed this, haven't you? Some of you will squirm when you hear me say this. You will probably look around and see if someone's looking at you right now, because this has happened to you already. And so you will think about it just like that when I say it. But our children have the uncanny ability to demonstrate their misbehavior before others. During a church service, for example. Or on a Sunday afternoon when we have visitors at the house. Or in the school classroom. And everyone sees it. The rest of the children in the school saw it. The teacher saw it. The school board heard about it. In the church service here, it kind of drew attention. And here we are. And we feel like everyone's eyes are just burning holes through us. Puts a lot of pressure on parents. And we immediately feel very, very vulnerable when this happens and pressed to try somehow or another to regain control. It's very easy for a parent to make mistakes here with that child. The first tendency is to respond with frustration, trying to correct our image before others. A tense and irritated parent is in no condition to offer lasting help to his child. I want you to look at a verse in the Bible that you don't know very well, although you know by heart a verse that's within 2 texts of this one. It's 22 Proverbs, verse 8. You know verse 6 by heart. This verse you might not know. Verse Verse 8 says, he that soweth iniquity shall reap vanity, and the rod of his anger shall fail. What does that mean? Well, I was careless at home in the private moment when I could have maybe have dealt with a maladjusted behavior of my son or daughter, child. I kind of let it go. I didn't feel it was important. I was busy at that time anyhow, and I wasn't up to it. Wasn't in the mood for it. So I just left it go, and so this character trait kind of keeps on developing, and now here we are in the classroom, or here we are in the church service, and this thing bursts out into full bloom, and everyone else sees it. And so I grab up this child, and soon there's going to be some thrashings around going on here somewhere, and the rod of my anger shall fail. It won't work. He that soweth iniquity shall reap vanity. This is a product of my own production. I was not pursuing this thing as I should have been. I wasn't making the conscious effort to win this heart. I wasn't aware. I wasn't thinking about it that I'm responsible to do this. And all of a sudden, when I get caught in this public moment, the reactions come full speed and we grab up and we go. The rod of his anger shall fail. That's what the Bible says. And I don't think I can improve what the Bible says. I think that's the way it's going to be. That's a serious consideration. Quick, jumpy reactions, grabbing up the child to haul him out of eyesight or earshot, will only heighten the tension and reveal that the child is controlling the parent instead of the other way around. But I have a question. Are we sure we would have responded at all had not others observed the actions of our children? Would we in private, with no one else observing, have been concerned about what our child did then? And would I have tried to carefully nurture my child, help him control his actions and behaviors? Would I have given him teaching? Would I have taken time to explain to him and talk to him? If it would have been a private moment instead of a public one, those are worthwhile questions to think about as a parent. And though paddling a child is and can be liberating for that young heart, that is not the only option. Paddling is not the only option open to us. I'd like to show you two other options. My Bible is still open to Proverbs. I go to chapter 29 this time to read verse 15. And it says here, the rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. And so the rod alone is one thing, and for as valuable as the rod is, it's not valuable enough. And after that time of correction is over, if I can sit that child down either beside me, it depends how old he is, or on my lap. It depends again how old the child is, if I can lay my hand on his shoulder, if I can get my handkerchief out of my pocket and wipe away those tears and dry him up. And they said, listen, son, before we go, I'd like to just talk to you a little bit. And those careful and wise words of a daddy talking to his son and reaching his heart and saying, I just want to tell you, son, what goals I have for you and why we did this today and just what happened. And here's some instruction for the future. If this happens again, son, just keep this in mind. This will be a better way to respond. It'll be good for you and good for the other. And teach your son and talk to him and give that verbal instruction and those words from your heart. To just simply give a whipping to your son and send him out the door and say, now go away. And give him the impression that you're relieved that he's out of your presence is destructive. That handling of it is maybe it's even worse than what the child had done wrong in the first place. But when we take time with that child and we're not finished, just because the paddling is over, and if you heard this before, I'm sorry, but she was 11 years old the last time I gave her a paddling. And I think it was handled in the right way. I think it was. That was not always the case with me. I said I have stubs left. On that particular occasion, there was a mistake there that was made. It was serious enough. We had to take care of it. And so I decided ahead of time how many times that would happen. We're not supposed to go beat until we can't go anymore. That was calculated. It was planned. It was decided ahead of time. And that was done. And Bethany was crying. Not very much, but a little bit. But Daddy was soon crying when, after the paddling was over, she did this. She spun around. She was a real big girl, for a tall girl for her age. And she grabbed me with both hands, with both arms, and she said, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, I love you, I love you." That's what she said. And that time right there, the words we say right there, the way we respond to that child right there, that's whether you have the child's heart or not. And let me tell you something. However much that paddling hurt the child physically, however much pain or whatever that would have put into the child, none of it will be remembered when that child leaves. None of that will be remembered. But something will be remembered. Something very, very beautiful has happened between the parent and the child. Do you read what it says here? Go to chapter 16, verse 6. By mercy and truth, iniquity is purged, and by the fear of the Lord, men depart from evil. Look at those words, dear father and mother. By mercy and truth, iniquity is purged. Anyone that knows the Heavenly Father has already learned that truth. By mercy and truth, iniquity is purged, and by the fear of the Lord, men depart from evil. You see, the purpose of that time of correction is not simply to cause pain or suffering. The goal, rather, is to correct the child. That is to make straight paths for his feet. That is to improve something in that child's life. That is to make him better afterwards than what he was before. The parent has a goal in mind for that child. And this is a way to direct that child that proper way. That, I don't like to see parents think and feel that with one solid, thorough, complete destroying of this child's will, we're going to get this thing fixed once and for all. I think of a grapevine growing on an arbor. That grapevine is your son, daughter. And this vine is not growing well. The new branches, the new shoots are coming out are going down towards the earth. They must go up and crawl up across that trestle. They must crawl up this way. And they're going the wrong way. And so you don't go up to the vine, you don't go up to that arbor and jerk those branches off the wires and the lath that it's growing on and jerk it off of there and take it up here and slam it up to the top. You destroyed the plant. It's over. But you had a little pruning tool and you clipped this off that was going the wrong way, tripped some of those off, and they just took this part here and turned it up and tied it fast to the next one up above. And a little while later, you came back and you tied it up a little higher. And this thing starts growing the right direction. And what you're doing when you're correcting a child is you have this, you're turning the direction of the child's life. You're turning the direction of their heart. And we're going to go this way, son, daughter. This is the way we go. And you have this vision for your child. And you have that plan in mind. And you're careful how you do it. And you're aware that that's not going to happen in 5 minutes. This is a job to do. And in teaching school, I've had many times parents come to me and say, "Brother Dale, you'll discover something when our child is in your room. You'll discover that this is, we only got this far. This is how far we've gotten. And we'd like to invite you to help us get the rest of it done. Would you help us as parents with what we're trying to do with our child?" And we don't do this quickly. This is a job that takes years. We have these terribly poisonous snakes in Costa Rica, and when they're born, they can kill a man the day they're born with their venom. But God has your child with you for at least 20 years to do something with that child's life. A rat needs his parents for a very, very short time, couple of weeks. And your child's with you for 20 years. There's a reason for that. It's a process, and we have a goal in mind. We set our affection on this task we have. A carefully planned discipline session might accomplish this goal for our child far, far more than just simply endless beating. Certainly better than endless criticism. A parent who's not in control of his own spirit will not gain the heart of his child. Angry parents will succeed in promoting rebellion in the home. As a child grows in age, listen, parents, as he grows in understanding, as he grows in social awareness, parents need to be more and more careful about shaming that child in public. Be careful about violating his person. Even with his weaknesses, be careful what you say about them. I think in those training sessions, those correction sessions, you should try to capitalize on doing that in private as much as you can, and not just capitalize on the public occurrences. Take care of it privately as much as you can. I'm going to make a few statements here that I can't measure with a yardstick. We can't put on the scales and weigh it. So these are subjective things that we cannot measure. But I want you to listen to a few things. Words of commendation, words of acclamation, words of confirmation and respect are probably more important, or at least as much so, as times of correction. I think of what Jesus heard his daddy say, his Father in heaven, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased." And I think you'd be well pleased in your son even when he makes mistakes. I think you'd be well pleased in your son even if he did not win the award. I think you can be pleased with your son even if all the people in the youth group and then at the church picnic saw your son with a bat in his hand, he struck out. He made three strikes and had to put the bat down and walk away. I think you can still feel in your heart, "That's my son right there. I'm very pleased with him. I'm blessed with my son." I think your son should know that you're glad that he helped to play the game, whether he hit a home run or not. I think it's in those moments there, even when our children make mistakes, that we have outstanding opportunities to win their hearts in ways that don't quite turn out that effective, but everything is so superlative and so expertly done and so carefully executed. I think it's easier to win the heart of a child when they make mistakes and when it didn't go so well. And they find out that daddy and mama still love me and care for me, and I'm still the apple of their eye, and they still have their affection set on me, even though it didn't turn out quite so well. Can you hear these words this morning, brothers? I don't know if you can hear these words or receive them. Prevention is as important as punishment. A child left himself, we've already read that, without understanding the parameters, will feel insecure and will surely bring his parents to shame. We read that verse already. Guiding a child into proper play, proper activity, productivity is worth as much or more as correcting him for wrong things and wrong choices done afterwards. Or correcting him afterwards for wrong things done. Limits are more wholesome than barriers. Establish limits for your home and let your child understand that inside the security of this parameter, he will have a blessed day and a blessed relationship and a blessed experience. Let him enjoy that. Let him feel the security of that. And a child that does not have that definition, he is never a fully developed child. Then I'll say this yet. How much time do I spend with my son, with my daughter in quality activity, quality interchange, personal interest in their lives. How much time do I spend with my children? And now we go to the second half of this. This is very important. And I'll try not to make this take too long. Gaining the heart of my son requires me to diligently keep, that is, guard my own heart. Guard my own testimony, my own spirit, my own peaceableness. Because this is paramount to a child's behavior. Paramount means of greater importance than. This will decide in a large extent how the child's behavior will develop. As we told Brother Andy this morning, the young ones have already observed him. They've already observed his ways. My children observe mine too. And none of us can go back, no matter who you are or how old you are, and correct our past failures as fathers and mothers. We cannot go back and do that. And please, children, no matter whether you are a 60-year-old child and your father is in the old people's home, your parents, no matter how old they are today, cannot correct the mistakes they made. And there's no father in here or mother that does not make mistakes. And when you younger ones, you youth that are here, this couple is getting married on the 8th of October. Wasn't that our marriage date, Mother? 8th of October, 56 years ago. This couple is getting married on the 8th of October, 2022. 56 years from now, we'll be quite a while down the road. We'll see how it goes. But that young couple getting married, if they ever get children, they will make mistakes too. Their parents made mistakes, their grandparents did, and they will continue in that process. Making mistakes is not the problem. It's the attitude that we have while we're making the mistake and the spirit we have after it's over. And with the home, with the children, learn about it from us. We all make mistakes. Please be forgiving of your parents. Please be forgiving your daddy if he's 80 years old today. Please be forgiving of your mother. You know, when the time came, I was someplace between 53 and 55 years old. I'm not exactly sure when I was. It was someplace between 53 and 55 when I was reunited with my father. Not reunited, united for the first time. Connected with him for the first time. When for the first time in my life, I had a dad. When that time came, he was completely unaware of what was going on. He was in an old people's home. No, he wasn't. He wasn't there yet. He was on the way there. He had Alzheimer's. He couldn't do things for himself. He couldn't remember where he was. And so my father did not contribute anything really to the change that happened in my heart. But after that change came and I was aware that I have a daddy, and I looked at him and looked at his eyes and saw that that was my father and recognized he was that for the first time in all my years, I went to the filing cabinet back here, someplace in the back of the brain where there was all kinds of folders in there stacked full of information and pictures and experiences and things said that gave me a terrible impression of him. And somehow that all went into the trash bin. It went into the dumpster. It was hauled off to the landfill of forgetfulness. And a new stack of stuff started filling up those folders and those drawers in the filing cabinet of my mind. I'll tell you one thing that happened. The boy would like to see his daddy. The boy would like for his daddy to see him play. So I was an electrician in the state of Tennessee, and I had a fairly high license there in that state and worked in five different electrical districts, each one with its own electrical inspectors. It was a very interesting opportunity we had there. And my father, who's now climbing up through the years, he came down to Tennessee to see us. So that was something that he only ever did once while we lived there. But next day I had to go to work. I had a responsibility there at a job site. And I decided to take a chance and do something. I decided to take him along. Now, this experience that I'm going to talk to you about now is before the restoration. It's before that healing happened. So he goes along with me to work, and I was always polite to him. I mean, I always treated him civilly. even though I had nothing but bad memories back there. So I got in there and I said, well, listen, Daddy, maybe you'd like to do something. So there was a bedroom there. I thought, take him in the bedroom and I'll let him put the receptacles in the walls around the bedroom. And so there were about five receptacles in that bedroom, and I took him to the first one. I gave him a receptacle. I gave him a needle-nosed pliers. I gave him several screwdrivers and showed him that this color wires go on this side and this color wires go on this side. And I showed him how that is. Then you pull those wires and put it back in there and screw that thing into the box and then put a cover on. Yeah, yeah. So I left you with that, and I was over here. I was wiring up a electrical panel. Everything was quiet in that bedroom, and I thought, what's going on over there? I waited about 20 minutes, and I went over there, and he was trying to put the first receptacle that he had put together, trying to put it into the wall. It takes me, you know, probably hardly a minute and a half to do one of those receptacles. That's probably long, but I don't want to make it wrong, so I'm going to say a minute and a half. I was thinking of saying 55 seconds, but I think I'll say a minute and a half. He was at it for 20 minutes and wasn't done. I said, Daddy, how's it going? Well, he wants to do this. I pulled it out, and the wires were at the wrong place. So I just quickly pulled them open, put it back in there. Daddy, it's all done. I said, try the next one. I went back to the panel. But you should have heard my dad talking on the way home from that job site in the afternoon. And I learned later what was going on there. I didn't think about it then. But my dad, in that little participation in that bedroom, probably for the first time in his life, saw me play. This is what Dale does. And today I could do it too. And I didn't catch that. I didn't know that was going on. I learned it later when he could do nothing about it. But I'm sharing these things with you because you need to have the heart of your child. We can't correct the things we've done wrong, but God can have mercy on us. Mercy and truth will take care of the iniquity. So I want to have a couple questions for you, Daddy and Mother. If you have a serious problem with your young person in your home, with one of your children, I'd like to ask you what your relationship is with your wife or with your husband. Do we have as husband and wife each other's hearts? Or are we in competition as parents for the affinity and affection of our children? Do we threaten each other? My wife's a threat threatens me and I'm a threat to her. Or do we delight in each other? If there's a discipline problem in the home, I would encourage us to start here. Look at this first, my relationship with my wife. Is there anger, frustration, or exasperation in my voice or actions? The Bible says in Spanish, do not exasperate your child. Your Bible says, do not provoke them to anger. The Spanish Bible says that in Ephesians, but in Colossians it says, do not bring your child to exasperation. And we can do that to our children. We can provoke them to anger. We can exasperate them by what we do. The main thing, way by which we do that is the voice with which we speak to them. The voice they hear from us when we talk to them. How do I relate to authority in my life, Daddy, Mama? In the church, in the civil situations. How do I relate to authority on the job? How do I relate to the authority of the school board? I know you don't have a school board here. You do your own schools. How to relate to my finances? Am I subject even there? Everything is in order and I accept the things that I cannot change and I'm satisfied with it and I'm not murmuring and fussing about it. How do I speak about authorities in my life? Am I under authority of myself or am I resisting it? These are questions that are so important if we're going to win the hearts of our children. What is the evidence of my own spiritual faith? Do I trust God? Do I have confidence in the brothers and sisters? Does the Word of God dwell in me richly in all wisdom, teaching me and admonishing me with songs and hymns and spiritual songs? Am I singing with grace and melody in my heart to the Lord? Do my children hear me sing? You see, Deuteronomy chapter 6 tells parents that this word that He's giving us must first of all be in our own hearts before we write them on the doorposts and speak of them when we're on the way and teach them to our children. This Shema, this the Lord our God being one Lord, and we should love Him with all our heart and soul, that should first be within us. And the Bible says in 2 Timothy chapter 1 that this first was in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice. That's where it first was. Before it was in Timothy, it was there. And it must be in me before it will be in Virgil and Bethany and Gabriel, Nathaniel, and Loretta. A mother told me these words. When I was young, I used to see my daddy sitting down reading his Bible, but my children see their daddy on his cell phone. You can think about that if you want to. Set your affection on things above, not on things of the earth. Is there enough evangelical unction to make my orthodoxy function? Yes, I can demand rigid compliance to my demands upon my children, but is my orthodoxy matched by doxology? That means, is my rigid requirement for my home matched by a gracefulness, a thankfulness, a worshipfulness that they sense in my heart? It's not hard at all to obey somebody, even do a few things that others don't do, when daddy and mother have this kind of gracious, worshipful attitude. Be careful about requiring your children to be unique and different from others in the church. Family conviction is healthy, and you can do things in your home that not everyone in the congregation expects of their children. But be careful that your boys and girls, especially your youth, do not feel odd when they're with others, because that will sooner or later cause them to give their hearts to somebody else. Do I cultivate the garden in my child's heart? How do you go about doing that? Blessed is the child who can tell his parents anything. He can come to his parents and tell them what he's scared of, tell him what he feels he failed, tell him what disappointments that he has in his life. Blessed be the child who can come to his parents and open up and say all of those things. Blessed is the child who wants daddy and mother to share in their joys, their little unique discoveries. And they sense our interest in their projects and in their efforts. Blessed be that child. Blessed be that relationship. And if I want them to be able to do that, I must be careful how I respond when they do fail. Respond when they do when they are scared of something. I taught my children to be scared of nothing. I was probably wrong in that. Our oldest son was probably only 4 or 5 years old when we had a bag of feed there, and it was about half empty. So the bag was here, and the feed was down there, and I looked in there. We're going to put some feed here to these animals, and there was a mouse running around on top of the feed in there. He saw this great big image looking down in there, and he was scared. So he was running around on top there, and I said to Virgil, I said, "See that mouse? Yeah, Daddy." I said, "Grab him." He had it just like that. He didn't know you have to be scared of a mouse. He had no idea about that. He was never taught that. They were taught to be scared of nothing. Don't be scared of lightning. Don't be scared of thunder. Don't be scared of dark. Don't be scared of a snake. Don't be scared of anything. But I was extreme that way. And I wish I wouldn't have been. I can't change it, but the stubs are still here. But when a child can tell you what they're scared of, that same boy, many years later, came home from his cheese and sour cream route selling his milk products in the village, and came to us and said he's concerned about something. When he goes to town and sells this stuff, he gets to this store right here and they buy some things from him, and the man, when he's ready to leave, says, "Virgil, she's waiting on you. She knows you're coming. She's ready." The next door down, there's a place that they usually buy from him. There's a young lady working in that store, and she's developing an interest in Virgil. And Virgil finds his heart skipping some beats when this man here tells him, she's waiting for you. And he became concerned. He came to us and said, I don't think I should keep on with that route. And so we stopped the cheese and cream route and sold our milk products at a considerable discount to save our son from that engagement, from that contact. When your children can come and tell you, this is what I'm facing, this is what I'm struggling with. Blessed is a young person here that can do that with your parents. And blessed are the parents that have their children doing that to them. But if we want them to do that, we should take interest in little projects. And if a child comes home with a report card and it's a real low grade in social studies, you can stand there and reprimand your child and say, this is going to change, son. The child feels inferior, feels ashamed, feels embarrassed. You can handle it another way, Daddy. Son, I see it's probably a little disappointing for you to get a grade like that right there. And I'm not quite sure why that happened, but listen, are there a few things that we can do until the next marking period that might help that a little bit? Listen, would you do me a favor? Would you periodically bring that book along home? Maybe we can scrub a couple things together and Daddy Mumble will help you. We'd like to see you try to get a little better grade there if you can, and we are here, you count on us. We'll do this together. We'll get through this. We'll review some lessons there. We will try to help that get a little better. And which of those daddies is going to win the heart of his son? These things are not hard to figure out. Cultivate the garden of your child's heart. Identify with your children in their needs as well as share in their successes. They just love to, when they're a little prattle, to show you the little thing that they did, the fort that they built, it's the thing that they're trying to do. And be careful about the crises in home life, financial crises, marriage crises, congregational crises, church divisions. These things destroy children to no end. Be very careful what you say about others. As parents, you don't need to face these stresses alone. Get help for yourself so that you can help your children. And these things and in lesser challenges, share your own heart with others and share your own heart with your children, because if you want them to give you their heart, you must give them your own. And now I'm going to close. I'm going to tell you a story and then I'm going to read a Bible verse. So you can turn to John chapter 5 a while. We had a dairy farm there in Tennessee, and we had 3 years of droughts, and we couldn't raise crops, and there was not enough hay, and we couldn't make any corn silage, and we every year rented more ground than the year before, and the ground was more expensive than the time before, and then those crops failed too, and so we were going down deeper and deeper and deeper financially, and the banks closed down in this town, and Federal Land Bank and Production Credit closed their doors, and Bill Weaver, who was hauling milk to San Antonio, Texas from our community, had 33 tractor trailer trucks hauling milk. And when the time these years of drought were over, he was not hauling one tractor trailer truck of milk. Milk in our county stopped. Many, many farmers went bankrupt. Man right up the road from me had several harvester silos, a slurry store, harvest store. He lost everything he had. We were struggling for all we could go. I was tense, tight. The money didn't reach. Didn't for anybody. Certainly didn't for us. The boys were in charge of the calves. They had them up there, up above the barn. There was a hill up there. There was a little building they were in. There was a bucket there with the water in. There was a place to put some hay for those animals. And this place, we went up there one day and it was all full of manure. The hay was down and trapped down into the manure. The water bucket was turned over, made that much more slop and mud and manure in the floor. And I took those boys and berated them thoroughly and said, what do you fellas think you're doing? And the three little boys felt terrible. They knew it was a mess. I'm sure they were ashamed. And I made it worse. A few days later, it was Christmas time, December 25, I got a cart there and I put some 2x4s on there and a saw and a couple of tools, some hammers and some nails there, and we put some extension cords on there and asked the boys to come with me. And so after breakfast, we went up there to that pen and we cleaned that all out and put some fresh stuff down, and we built a little frame to set that bucket in so that when it was filled with water, the cats couldn't knock it over. And we built a nice little shelf there for a trough and put a hay rack above it. And so when you put this hay in there, any leaves would fall down onto the trough so they could eat that too. And it was kind of a pleasant time. It just was a building up and the accomplishment and the improvement. And these boys were helping their daddy. Or maybe daddy was helping the boys. That evening, we got home and we had supper, and that was the end of the Christmas day, and the children went to bed. And I went into the study, and my Bible was there, and I looked at my Bible, and there was a piece of paper on top of my Bible. And I picked this up. It was from my oldest son. "Daddy, what a beautiful day. You helped us. It was so nice. Thank you, Daddy." And I thought of this way of handling it. And I thought of this way of handling it. And there's stubs on the fingers. But I've got to read you a Bible verse. It's chapter 5, verse 19. And here's the answer to your question. "Then answered Jesus and said unto them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of himself, but what he seeth the Father do. For what things soever he doeth, these also doeth the Son likewise." And Brother Andy, you will know that you have Kevin's heart. And you see him wanting to do it the way Daddy did it. You see him following Daddy's footsteps. When you hear him say to one of his friends, "But my daddy did it like this." And Kevin says, "I want a better trip than that. But please have enough grace, Andy, to allow Kevin to do something that you have not done. Allow him to do it better than you did it. Allow him, with the arrow in the hand of a mighty man, allow him to go further than you've ever gone." And encourage him and say, "Thank you, son." And when you see your children, they will do it the way Daddy did it. They remember what they saw there, and they're blessed with that, and they love that, and they appreciate that, and they embrace those values, and they do it like you and I have done it. Then we know where their hearts are.